12. When they go downstairs, Dan Bell isn't exactly sitting in the stair chair. It's more like lolling. No longer just tired, exhausted. Holly really doesn't want to trouble him further, but will have to. Dan Bell also knows they're not done. He asks Brad to bring him a knock of whiskey.
Grandpa, the doctor said.
Fuck the doctor and the horse he rode in on, Dan says. It'll brighten me up. We'll finish. You show Holly that last thing, and then I'll lie down. I slept through last night, and I bet I will again tonight. This is such a weight off my shoulders.
But now it's on mine, Holly thinks. I wish Ralph was here. I wish for Bill even more. Brad brings his gramps a Flintstone jelly glass with barely enough whiskey in it to cover the bottom. Dan gives it a sour look, but accepts it without comment. From the side pocket of his wheelchair, he takes a bottle of pills with a geriatric-friendly screw-off cap. He shakes out a pill and half a dozen others spill onto the floor.
Balls, says the old man. Pick those up, Brad.
I'll get them, Holly says, and does. Dan, meanwhile, puts the pill in his mouth and swallows it with the whiskey.
Now I know that's not a good idea, Grandpa, Brad says, sounding prissy.
At my funeral, no one will say I died young and handsome, Dan replies.
Some color has come into his cheeks, and he's sitting up straight in his chair again.
Holly, I have perhaps 20 minutes before that almost useless dram of whiskey wears off. Half an hour, at most. I know you have more questions, and we have one more thing for you to look at, but let's try to be brief.
Joel Lieberman, she says. The psychiatrist you saw in Boston starting in 2018.
What about him?
You didn't go to him because you thought you were crazy, did you?
Of course not. I went for the same reasons I imagined you went to see Carl Morton, with his books and lectures about people with weird neuroses. I went to tell everything I knew to someone who was paid to listen, and to find someone else who had reasons to believe the unbelievable. I was looking for you, Holly, just as you were looking for me.
Yes, it's true. Still, she thinks, it's a miracle we got together. Or fate. Or God.
Although Morton changed all the names and locations for his article, it was easy for Brad to track you down. The thing calling itself Ondowski wasn't there reporting from the Texas cave, by the way. Brad and I looked at all the news footage.
Holly says, my outsider didn't show up on tape or film. There was footage where he should have been part of a crowd, but he wasn't there. She taps the drawings of Ondowski in his various guises. This perp is on TV all the time.
Then he's different, the old man says and shrugs. The way house cats and bobcats are different, but similar. Same template, different models. As for you, Holly, you were barely mentioned in the news reports, never by name, only as a private citizen who helped with the investigation.
I asked to be kept out of it, Holly mutters.
By then I'd read about Carolyn H. and Dr. Morton's articles. I tried to reach out to you with Dr. Lieberman. Made a trip to Boston to see him, which wasn't easy. I knew that even if you hadn't recognized Ondowski for what he was, you would have good reason to believe my story if you heard it. Lieberman called your guy Morton, and here you are.
One thing troubles Holly, and very much. She says, why now? You've known about this thing for years. You've been hunting it.
Not hunting, Dan says. Keeping track would be a more accurate way to put it. Since 2005 or so, Brad has been monitoring the internet. In every tragedy, every mass shooting, we look for him, don't we, Brad?
Yes, Brad says.
He's not always there. He wasn't at Sandy Hook or in Las Vegas when Stephen Paddock killed all those concert goers. But he was working at WFTV in Orlando in 2016. He interviewed survivors from the Pulse nightclub shooting the next day. He always picks the ones who are most upset, the ones who were inside or lost friends who were. Of course he does, Holly thinks. Of course. Their grief is tasty. But we didn't know he was at the nightclub until after the school bombing last week, Brad says. Did we, Grandpa?
No, Dan agrees. Even though we checked all the Pulse News footage as a matter of course during the aftermath.
How did you miss him? Holly asks. Pulse was over 4 years ago. You said you'd never forget a face. And by then, you knew Andowski's. Even with the changes, it's always the same. A pig face. They look at her with identical frowns, so Holly explains what Bill told her about most people having either pig faces or fox faces. In every version she's seen here, Andowski's face is rounded. Sometimes a little, sometimes a lot, but it's always a pig face. Brad still looks puzzled, but his grandfather smiles.
That's good. I like it. Although there are exceptions. Some people have...
horse faces, Holly finishes for him.
Just what I was going to say. And some people have weasel faces. Although I suppose you could say weasels have a certain foxy aspect, don't they? Certainly, Philip Hannigan...
He trails off.
Yes, and in that aspect, I bet he always has a fox face.
I don't understand you.
But you will, Dan says. Show her the Pulse clip, Brad.
Brad starts the clip and turns the iPad to face Holly. Again, it's a reporter doing stand-up, this time in front of a huge pile of flowers and heart balloons and signs saying things like, more love and less hate. The reporter is beginning to interview a sobbing young man with the remains of either dirt or mascara smudging his cheeks. Holly doesn't listen, and this time she doesn't scream because she doesn't have the breath to do it. The reporter, Philip Hannigan, is young, blonde, skinny. He looks like he stepped into the job right out of high school. And yes, he has what Bill Hodges would have called a fox face. He is looking at his interview subject with what could be concern, empathy, sympathy, or barely masked greed.
Freeze it, Dan says to Brad, and to Holly. Are you all right?
That's not Andowski, she whispers. That's George. That's the man who delivered the bomb to the MacReady School.
Oh, but it is Andowski, Dan says.
He speaks gently, almost kindly.
I already told you, this creature doesn't have just one template. He has two. At least two.
13. Holly turned off her phone before knocking on the Bell's door and doesn't think to turn it on again until she's back in her room at the Embassy Suites. Her thoughts are swirling like leaves in a strong wind. When she does power up to continue her report to Ralph, she sees that she has 4 texts, 5 missed calls, and 5 voicemail messages. The missed calls and voicemails are all from her mother. Charlotte knows how to text. Holly showed her. But she never bothers, at least when it comes to her daughter. Holly thinks her mother has found texting insufficient when it comes to crafting a really effective guilt trip. She opens the texts first. Pete.
All okay, H. I'm minding the store, so do your thing. If you need something, ask.
Holly smiles at that. Barbara.
I got the movies. They look good. Thanks. We'll return. Smiley face.
Jerome.
Maybe have a line on that chocolate lab. In Parma Heights. Going to check. If you need something, I'm on my cell. Don't hesitate.
The last one also from Jerome. Holly Berry. Smiley face.
In spite of all she's learned at the house on Lafayette Street, she has to laugh. And she has to tear up a little, too. They all care for her. And she cares for them. It's amazing. She'll try to hold on to that while she deals with her mother. She already knows how each of Charlotte's voicemails will end.
Holly, where are you? Call me. That's the first. Holly, I need to speak to you about going to see your uncle this weekend. Call me. The second. Where are you? Why is your phone off? It's very inconsiderate. What if there was an emergency? Call me. The third. That woman from Rolling Hills, Mrs. Braddock, I didn't like her. She seemed very full of herself. She called and said Uncle Henry is very upset. Why aren't you returning my calls? Call me.
Big number four. The fifth is simplicity itself.
Call me.
Holly goes into the bathroom, opens her Notions bag, and takes an aspirin. Then she gets down on her knees and folds her hands on the edge of the tub. God, this is Holly. I need to call my mother now. Help me to remember I can stand up for myself without being all nasty and poopy and getting into an argument. Help me to finish another day without smoking. I still miss cigarettes, especially at times like this. I still miss Bill, too. But I'm glad Jerome and Barbara are in my life. Pete, too, even though he can be a little slow on the uptake sometimes. She starts to stand, then resumes the position. I also miss Ralph and hope he's having a nice vacation with his wife and son. Thus armored, or so she hopes, Holly calls her mother. Charlotte does most of the talking. That Holly won't tell her where she is, what she's doing, or when she'll be back makes Charlotte very angry. Beneath the anger, Holly senses fear, because Holly has escaped. Holly has a life of her own. That was not supposed to happen.
Whatever you're doing, you have to be back this weekend, Charlotte says. We need to go see Henry together. We're his family, all he's got.
I may not be able to do that, Mom.
Why? I want to know why.
Because I'm chasing the case. That's what Bill would have said.
Because I'm working.
Charlotte begins to cry. For the last 5 years or so, it has always been her last resort when it comes to bringing Holly to heel. It no longer works, but it's still her default position, and it still hurts.
I love you, Mom, Holly says, and ends the call.
Is that true?
Yes. It's liking that got lost, and love without liking is like a chain with a manacle at each end. Could she break the chain? Strike off the manacle?
Perhaps. She's discussed that possibility with Allie Winters many times, especially after her mother told her, proudly, that she voted for Donald Trump.
Oof.
Will she do it? Not now. Maybe never. When Holly was growing up, Charlotte Gibney taught her, patiently, perhaps even with good intentions, that she was thoughtless, helpless, hapless, careless, that she was less. Holly believed that until she met Bill Hodges, who thought she was more. Now she has a life, and it is more often than not a happy one. If she broke with her mother, it would lessen her. I don't want to be less, Holly thinks, as she sits on the bed in her Embassy Suites room. Been there, done that, and got the T-shirt, she adds.
She takes a Coke from the bar refrigerator. Damn the caffeine. Then she opens her phone's recording app and continues her report to Ralph. Like praying to a god she can't quite believe in, it clears her head. And by the time she finishes, she knows how she'll go forward. 14. From Holly Gibney's report to Detective Ralph Anderson. From here on, Ralph, I'll try to give you my conversation with Dan and Brad Bell verbatim while it's still fresh in my mind. It won't be completely accurate, but it will be close. I should have recorded our talk, but never thought of it. I still have a lot to learn about this job. I only hope I get the chance. I could see that Mr. Bell, the old Mr. Bell, wanted to go on, but once that little bit of whiskey wore off, he couldn't. He said he needed to lie down and rest. The last thing he said to Brad was something about the sound recordings. I didn't understand that. Now I do. His grandson wheeled him away to his bedroom, but first he gave me his iPad and opened a photo stream for me. I looked at the pictures while he was gone. Then I looked at them again, and I was still looking at them when Brad came back. 17 photos, all taken from videos on the internet. All of Chet Undowski in his various... Pause. His various incarnations, I guess you'd say. And an 18th. The one of Philip Hannigan, outside the Pulse nightclub 4 years ago. No mustache. Blonde hair instead of dark. Younger than in the security camera photo of George in his fake delivery uniform. But it was him, all right. Same face underneath. Same fox face. But not the same as Undowski. No way was he. Brad came back with a bottle and 2 more jelly glasses. Grandpa's whiskey, he said. Maker's Mark. Do you want a little? When I said no, he poured quite a bit into one of the glasses. Well, I need some, he said. Did Grandpa tell you I was gay? Terribly gay. I said he had, and Brad smiled. That's how he starts every conversation about me, he said. He wants to get it right out front, on the record, to show he doesn't mind, but of course he does. He loves me, but he does. When I said I felt sort of the same way about my mother, he smiled and said that we had something in common. I guess we do. He said his grandfather had always been interested in what he called the second world. Stories about telepathy, ghosts, strange disappearances, lights in the sky. He said, some people collect stamps. My grandpa collects stories about the second world. I had my doubts about all that stuff until this. He pointed at the iPad, where the picture of George was still on the screen. George with his package full of explosives, waiting to be buzzed into the MacCready school office. Brad said, now I think I could believe in anything from flying saucers to killer clowns, because there really is a second world. It exists because people refuse to believe it's there. I know that's true, Ralph, and so do you. It's how the thing we killed in Texas survived as long as it did. I asked Brad to explain why his grandfather waited so long, although by then I had a pretty good idea. He said his grandfather thought it was basically harmless, a kind of exotic chameleon, and if not the last of its species, then one of the last. It lives off grief and pain, maybe not a nice thing, but not so different from maggots living off decaying flesh or buzzards and vultures living off roadkill. Coyotes and hyenas live that way too, Brad said. They're the janitors of the animal kingdom. And are we really any better? Don't people slow down for a good long look at an accident on the turnpike? That's roadkill, too. I said I always looked away and said a prayer that the people involved in the accident would be all right. He said if that was true, I was an exception. He said that most people like pain as long as it's not theirs. Then he said, I suppose you don't watch horror movies either? Well, I do, Ralph, but those movies are make-believe. When the director calls cut, the girl who had her throat slashed by Jason or Freddy gets up and grabs a cup of coffee. But still, after this, I may not. Pause. Never mind, I don't have time to ramble off the subject. Brad said, for every clip of killings or disasters that Grandpa and I have collected, there are hundreds more, maybe thousands. News people have a saying, if it bleeds, it leads. That's because the stories people are most interested in are bad news stories. Murders, explosions, car crashes, earthquakes, tidal waves. People like that stuff, and they like it even more now that there's cell phone video. The security footage recorded inside Pulse, when Omar Mateen was still rampaging, that has millions of hits. Millions. He said Mr. Bell thought this rare creature was only doing what all the people who watch the news do, feeding on tragedy. The monster, he didn't call it an outsider, was just fortunate enough to live longer by doing it. Mr. Bell was content to watch and marvel until he saw the security camera still of the MacCready school bomber. He has that memory for faces, and he knew he'd seen a version of that face at some act of violence not that long ago. It took Brad less than an hour to isolate Philip Hannigan. I found the MacCready school bomber 3 more times so far, Brad said, and showed me pictures of the fox-faced man. Always different, but always George underneath, doing 3 different stand-ups. Hurricane Katrina in 2005, Illinois tornadoes in 2004, and the World Trade Center in 2001. I'm sure there are more, but I haven't had time enough to hunt them out. Maybe it's a different man, I said, or creature. I was thinking that if there were 2, Andowski and the one we killed in Texas, there might be 3, or 4, or a dozen. I remembered a show I saw on PBS about endangered species. Only 60 black rhinos left in the world. Only 70 Amur leopards. But that's a lot more than 3. No, Brad said. It's the same guy. I asked him how he could be so sure. Grandpa used to do sketches for the police, he said. I sometimes do court-ordered wiretaps for them. And a few times I've mic'd up UCs. You know what those are? I did, of course, undercovers. No more mics under shirts, Brad said. We use bogus cufflinks or shirt buttons these days. I once put a mic in the B logo of a Red Sox hat. B for bug, get it? But that's only part of what I do. Watch this. He pulled his chair close to mine so we could both see his iPad. He opened an app called VocaNo. There were several files inside it. One was labeled Paul Freeman. He was the version of Andowski who reported the plane crash in 1960, you remember. Brad pushed play, and I heard Freeman's voice only crisper and clearer. Brad said he had cleaned the audio and dropped out the background noise. He called that sweetening the track. The voice came from the iPad speaker. On the screen, I could see the voice, the way you can see sound waves at the bottom of your phone or tablet when you tap the little microphone icon to send an audio text message. Brad called that a spectrogram voice print, and he claims to be a certified voice print examiner.
has given testimony in court. Can you see that force we talked about at work here, Ralph? I can. Grandfather and grandson, one good with pictures, the other good with voices. Without both, this thing, their outsider, would still be wearing his different faces and hiding in plain sight. Some people would call it chance or coincidence, like picking the winning numbers in a lottery. But I don't believe it. I can't, and I don't want to. Brad put Freeman's plane crash audio on repeat. Next, he opened the sound file for Andowski, reporting from the MacCready School, and also put that one on repeat. The two voices overlapped each other, turning everything into meaningless gabble. Brad muted the sound and used his finger to separate the two spectrograms, Freeman on the top half of his iPad and Andowski on the bottom half. "You see, don't you?" he asked, and of course I did. The same peaks and valleys were running across both, almost in sync. There were a few minor differences, but it was basically the same voice, although the recordings had been made 60 years apart. I asked Brad how the two waveforms could look so similar when Freeman and Andowski were saying different things. "His face changes, and his body changes," Brad said, "but his voice never does. It's called vocal uniqueness. He tries to change it. Sometimes he raises the pitch, sometimes he lowers it, sometimes he even tries a little bit of an accent, but he doesn't try very hard." I said, "Because he's confident the physical changes are enough, along with the changes in location." "I think so," Brad said. "Here's something else. Everyone also has a unique delivery, a certain rhythm that's determined by breath units. Look at the peaks. That's Freeman punching certain words. Look at the valleys where he takes a breath. Now look at Andowski." They were the same, Ralph. "There's one other thing," Brad said. "Both voices pause on certain words, always with S or TH sounds in them. I think at some point, God knows how long ago, this thing talked with a lisp. But of course a TV news reporter can't lisp. He's taught himself to correct it by touching his tongue to the roof of his mouth, keeping it away from his teeth, because that's where a lisp happens. It's faint, but it's there. Listen." He played me a soundbite of Andowski at the middle school, the part where he says, "The explosive device may have been in the main office." Brad asked if I heard it. I asked him to play it again to make sure it wasn't just my imagination trying to hear what Brad said was there. It wasn't imagination. "Andowski says the explosive device may have been in the main office." Next, he played a soundbite of Paul Freeman at the 1960 crash site. Freeman says he was thrown from the rear section of the plane, still on fire. "And I heard it again, Ralph, those tiny pauses on section and still. The tongue touching the roof of the mouth to stop the lisp." Brad put a third spectrogram on his tablet. It was Philip Hannigan interviewing the young man from Pulse, the kid with the smudged mascara on his cheeks. I couldn't hear the young man because Brad scrubbed his voice out along with all the background noises, like sirens and people talking. It was just Hannigan, just George, and he could have been right in the room with us. "What was it like in there, Rodney? And how did you escape?" Brad played it for me three times. The peaks and valleys on the spectrogram matched the ones still running above it, Freeman and Andowski. That was the technical part, Ralph, and I could appreciate it. But what really got to me, what gave me the chills, were those tiny pauses. Short on "what was it like,"
longer on escape, which must be especially hard for Lispers to conquer. Brad asked me if I was satisfied, and I said I was. Nobody who hasn't been through what we've been through would have been, but I was. He isn't the same as our outsider, who had to hibernate during his transformations and couldn't be seen on video. But he's certainly that being's first or second cousin. There's so much about these things we don't know, and I suppose we never will. I need to stop now, Ralph. I haven't had anything to eat today but a bagel and a chicken sandwich and a little bit of a turnover. If I don't get something soon, I'll probably pass out. More later. 15. Holly orders out to Domino's, a small veggie pizza and a large Coke. When the young man shows up, she tips according to Bill Hodges' rule of thumb, 15% of the bill if the service is fair, 20% if the service is good. This young man is prompt, so she tips the full amount. She sits at the little table by the window, munching away and watching as dusk begins to steal over the Embassy Suites parking lot. A Christmas tree is blinking its lights on and off down there, but Holly has never had less Christmas spirit in her life. Today, the thing she's investigating was only pictures on a TV screen and spectrograms on an iPad. Tomorrow, if all goes as she hopes it will, she has Holly hope she'll be face to face with it. That will be scary. It has to be done. She has no choice. Dan Bell is too old and Brad Bell is too scared. He flat out refused, even after Holly explained that what she planned to do in Pittsburgh couldn't possibly put him at risk.
You don't know that, Brad said. For all you know, the thing's telepathic.
I've been face to face with one, Holly had replied. If it was telepathic, Brad, I'd be dead, and it would still be alive.
I'm not going, Brad said. His lips were trembling. My grandpa needs me. He's got a very bad heart. Don't you have friends?
She does, and one is a very good cop. But even if Ralph was in Oklahoma, would she risk him? He's got a family. She doesn't. As for Jerome, no. No way. The Pittsburgh part of her budding plan really shouldn't be dangerous, but Jerome would want to be all in, and that would be dangerous. There's Pete, but her partner has almost zero imagination. He'd do it, but treat the whole thing as a joke. And if there's one thing Chet Ondowski isn't, it's a joke. Dan Bell might have taken the shapeshifter on when he was younger, but in those years he was content to just watch, fascinated when it popped up from time to time, a Where's Waldo of disaster, feeling almost sorry for it, maybe. But now, things have changed. Now, it is no longer content to live on the aftermath of tragedy, gobbling grief and pain before the blood dries. This time, it brought the carnage. And if it gets away with it once, it will do it again. Next time, the death toll may be much higher, and Holly will not allow that. She opens her laptop on the room's chintzy excuse for a desk and finds the email from Brad Bell she was expecting. Attached is what you requested. Please use the materials wisely, and please keep us out of it. We have done what we can. Well, Holly thinks, not quite. She downloads the attachment and then calls Dan Bell's phone. She expects Brad to answer again, but it's the old man, sounding relatively rejuvenated. There's nothing like a nap to do that. Holly takes one whenever she can, but these days the opportunity doesn't come around as often as she'd like. Dan, it's Holly. Can I ask you one more question?
Shoot.
How does he move from job to job without being discovered? This is the age of social media. I don't understand how that works.
For a few seconds, there's only the sound of his heavy, oxygen-assisted breathing. Then he says,
"We've talked about that, Brad and I. We have some ideas. He... it... wait. Brad wants the damn phone."
There's a smatter of talk she can't pick up, but Holly gets the gist. The old guy doesn't like being co-opted. Then Brad is on.
"You want to know how he keeps getting jobs on TV?"
"Yes."
"It's a good question. Really good.
We can't be sure, but we think he jimmies his way in." "Jimmies?"
"It's a broadcast term. Jimmying is how radio personalities and TV reporters move up in big markets. In those places, there's always at least one local TV station, small, unaffiliated, pays peanuts. They mostly do community affairs. Everything from opening a new bridge to charity drives to city council meetings. This guy gets on the air there, does a few months, then applies at one of the big stations using audition tapes from the little local station. Anybody seeing those tapes would get right away that he's good at the job. A pro." Brad gives a short laugh. "He'd have to be, wouldn't he? He's been doing it for at least 60 damn years. Practice makes perf..."
The old man interrupts with something. Brad says he'll tell her, but that isn't good enough for Holly. She's suddenly impatient with both of them. "It's been a long day."
"Brad, put the phone on speaker."
"Huh? Oh, okay, good idea."
"I think he was doing it on radio, too."
Dan bawls. It's as if he thinks they're communicating with tin cans on a wax string. Holly winces and holds the phone away from her ear.
"Grandpa, you don't have to talk so loud."
Dan lowers his voice, but only slightly.
"On the radio, Holly. Even before there was TV. And before there was radio, he might have been covering bloodshed for the newspapers. God knows how long he, it, has been alive."
"Also," Brad says, "he must have a rolling file of references. Probably the aspect you call George writes some for Ondowski, and the one you call Ondowski has written some for George, you understand?"
Holly does, sort of. It makes her think of a joke Bill told her once about brokers marooned on a desert island getting rich trading each other's clothes.
"Let me talk, goddammit," Dan says. "I understand as well as you do, Bradley. I'm not stupid."
Brad sighs. Living with Dan Bell can't be easy, Holly thinks. On the other hand, living with Brad Bell is probably no bed of roses either.
"Holly, it works, because TV talent is a seller's market at big local affiliates. People move up, some quit the business, and he's good at the job."
"It," Brad says, "it's good at the job."
She hears coughing, and Brad tells his grandfather to take one of his pills.
"Jesus, will you stop being such an old woman?"
Felix and Oscar yelling at each other across the generation gap, Holly thinks. It might make a good sitcom, but when it comes to getting information, it's extremely poopy.
"Dan, Brad, will you stop?"
Bickering is the word that comes to mind, but Holly can't quite bring herself to say it, even though she's wound tight.
"Stop your discussion for a minute."
They are blessedly quiet.
"I understand what you're saying, and it makes sense as far as it goes. But what about his work history? Where he went to broadcasting school? Don't they wonder? Ask questions."
Dan says gruffly,
"He probably tells them he's been out of the business for a while and decided to get back in."
"But we don't really know,"
Brad says. He sounds pissed, either because he can't answer Holly's question to her satisfaction, or to his own, or because he's smarting over being called an old woman.
"Listen, there was a kid in Colorado who posed as a doctor for almost 4 years, prescribed drugs, even did operations. Maybe you read about it. He was 17, passing for 25, and didn't have a college degree in anything, let alone medicine. If he could slip through the cracks, this outsider could.
Are you done? Dan asks.
Yes, Grandpa, and sighs.
Good, because I have a question.
Are you going to meet him, Holly?
Yes. Along with the pictures, Brad has included a spectrograph screen grab of Freeman, Ondowski, and Philip Hannigan, a.k.a. George the Bomber. To Holly's eye, all three look identical.
When?
I hope tomorrow, and I'd like you both to keep completely quiet about this, please. Will you do that?
We will, Brad says. Of course we will. Won't we, Grandpa?
As long as you tell us what happens, Dan says. If you can, that is.
I used to be a cop, Holly, and Brad works with the cops. We probably don't have to tell you that meeting him could be dangerous, will be dangerous.
I know, Holly says in a small voice. I work with an ex-cop myself. And worked with an even better one before him, she thinks.
Will you be careful?
I'll try, Holly says, but she knows there always comes a point when you have to stop being careful. Jerome talked about a bird that carried evil like a virus, all frowsy and frosty gray, he said. If you wanted to catch it and wring its fracking neck, there came a time when you had to stop being careful. She doesn't think that will happen tomorrow, but it will soon. Soon. 16. Jerome has turned the space over the Robinsons' garage into a writing room and is using it to work on his book about great-great-gramps Alton, also known as the Black Owl. He's beavering away on it this evening when Barbara lets herself in and asks Jerome if she's interrupting. Jerome tells her he can use a break. They get Cokes from the small refrigerator nestled beneath one sloping eave. Where is she? Barbara asks. Jerome sighs. No, how's your book going, Jay? No, did you find that chocolate lab, Jay? Which I did, by the way. Safe and sound. Good for you. And how's your book going, Jay?
Up to page 93, he says, and sweeps a hand through the air.
I'm sailing.
That's good, too. Now, where is she?
Jerome takes his phone out of his pocket and touches an app called Web Watcher.
See for yourself. Barbara studies the screen.
The airport in Portland? Portland, Maine? What's she doing there?
Why don't you call her and ask, Jerome says. Just say Jerome snuck a tracker on your phone, Holly Berry, because we're worried about you, so what are you up to? Spill it, girl. Think she'd like that?
Don't joke, Barbara says. She'd be super pissed. That would be bad, but she'd also be hurt, and that would be worse. Besides, we know what it's about, don't we?
Jerome had suggested, just suggested, that Barbara could peek at the history on Holly's home computer when she went to pick up those movies for her school report. If, that was, Holly's password at home was the same as the one she used at work. That turned out to be the case, and while Barbara had felt extremely creepy and stalkerish about looking at her friend's search history, she had done it. Because Holly hadn't been the same after her trip to Oklahoma and subsequent trip to Texas, where she had nearly been killed by an off-the-rails cop named Jack Hoskins. There was a great deal more to that story than her near miss that day, and both of them knew it, but Holly refused to talk about it. And at first that seemed okay, because little by little the haunted look had left her eyes. She had returned to normal. Holly normal, at least. But now she was gone, doing something she'd refused to talk about. So Jerome had decided to track Holly's location with the Web Watcher app. And Barbara had looked at Holly's search history. And Holly, trusting soul that she was, at least when it came to her friends, had not wiped it. Barbara discovered Holly had looked at many trailers for upcoming movies, had visited Rotten Tomatoes and Huffington Post, and had several times visited a dating site called Hearts and Friends. Who knew? but many of her current searches had to do with the terrorist bombing at the Albert McCready Middle School. There were also searches for Chet Ondowski, a TV reporter at WPEN in Pittsburgh, a place called Clausen's Diner in Pierre, Pennsylvania, and someone named Fred Finkel, who turned out to be a cameraman at WPEN. Barbara took all this to Jerome and asked if he thought Holly might be on the verge of some sort of weirdo breakdown, maybe kicked off by the McCready school bombing. Maybe she's like flashing back to when her cousin Janie got blown up by Brady Hartsfield. Based on her searches, it certainly crossed Jerome's mind that Holly had caught the scent of another really bad man. But there's something else that seemed, to him at least, equally plausible. "Hearts and friends," he says to his sister now. "What about it? Has it not occurred to you that Holly might be, don't gasp, hooking up? Or at least meeting a guy she's exchanged emails with?" Barbara stares at him with her mouth open, almost laughs, then doesn't. What she says is, "Meaning what?" Jerome says. "Give me some insight here. You spend girl time with her." "Sexist, Jay." He ignores that. "Does she have a friend of the male persuasion, now or ever?" Barbara considers this carefully. "You know what? I don't think so. I think she might still be a virgin." "What about you, Barb?" is the thought that immediately jumps into Jerome's mind, but some questions should not be asked of 18-year-old girls by their big brothers. "She's not gay or anything," Barbara hastens on. "She never misses a Josh Brolin flick, and when we saw that stupid shark movie a couple of years ago, she actually moaned when she saw Jason Statham with his shirt off. Do you really think she'd go all the way to Maine for a date?" "The plot thickens," he says, peering into his phone. "She's not at the airport. If you zoom in, you'll see it's Embassy Suites. She's probably drinking champagne with some guy who likes frozen daiquiris, strolling in the moonlight, and discussing classic films." Barbara makes as if to punch him in the face, only springing her hand open at the last second. "Tell you what," Jerome says, "I think we better leave this alone." "For real?" "I think so, yeah. We need to remember that she survived Brady Hartsfield twice. Whatever happened in Texas, she got through that too. She's a little shaky on top, but down deep, solid steel." "Got that right," Barbara says. Looking at her browser, that made me feel skeevy. "This makes me feel skeevy," he says, and taps the blinking dot on his phone that marks the Embassy Suites. "I'm going to sleep on it, but if I feel the same in the morning, I'm going to dump it. She's a good woman. Brave. Lonely, too." "And her mother's a witch," Barbara adds. Jerome doesn't disagree. "Maybe we should just let her alone, work it out, whatever it is." "Maybe we should." But Barbara looks unhappy about it. Jerome leans forward. "One thing I know for sure, Barb. She's never going to find out that we tracked her at all, is she?" "Never," Barbara says. "Or that I peeked at her searches." "Good. We have that straight. Now can I go back to work? I want to get another 2 pages before I knock off." 17. Holly isn't even close to knocking off. In fact, she's just about to get started on the evening's real work. She thinks about kneeling for a little more prayer first and decides she would only be procrastinating. She reminds herself that God helps those who help themselves. Chet Ondowski's Chet on Guard segment has its own webpage where folks who feel they have been burned can call in on an 800 number. This line is manned, or womaned, 24 hours a day, and the page claims all calls will be kept absolutely confidential. Holly takes a deep breath and makes the call. It rings just a single time. "Chet on Guard, this is Monica speaking. How may I help?"
"Monica, I need to speak to Mr. Ondowski. It's quite urgent."
The woman responds smoothly and with no hesitation. Holly's sure she's got a script, complete with possible variations, on the screen in front of her.
"I'm sorry, ma'am, but Chet has either left for the day or is on assignment.
I'll be happy to take your contact information and pass it on to him. Some information on the nature of your consumer complaint would also be helpful.
This isn't exactly a consumer complaint, she says, but it is about consuming. Will you tell him that, please?
Ma'am?
Monica is clearly puzzled.
I need to speak to him tonight, and before 9 p.m. Tell him it concerns Paul Freeman and the plane crash. Have you got that?
Yes, ma'am.
Holly can hear the clitter, clitter, clitter of the woman typing.
Tell him it also concerns Dave Van Pelt in Dallas and Jim Avery in Detroit. And tell him, this is very important, that it concerns Philip Hannigan and the Pulse nightclub.
This startles Monica out of her previously smooth delivery.
Isn't that where the man shot?
Yes, Holly says. Tell him to call by 9, or I will take my information elsewhere. And don't forget to tell him it's not about consumers, but it is about consuming. He'll know what that means.
Ma'am, I can pass the message on, but I can't guarantee if you pass it on, he'll call,
Holly says, and hopes she's right, because she doesn't have a plan B.
I need your contact information, ma'am.
You have my number on your screen, Holly says. I'll wait for Mr. Ondowski's call to give my name. Please have a pleasant evening.
Holly ends the call, wipes sweat from her brow, and checks her Fitbit. Heart rate is 89. Not bad. There was a time when a call like this would have rammed it up over 150.
She looks at the clock. 7:15. She takes her book out of her travel bag and immediately puts it back. She's too tense to read. So she paces.
At 7:45, she's in the bathroom with her shirt off, washing her armpits. She doesn't use deodorant. Aluminum chlorohydrate is supposed to be safe, but she has her doubts when her phone rings. She takes 2 deep breaths, sends up the briefest of prayers, God help me not to frack up, and answers.
18. Her phone screen says, unknown. Holly isn't surprised. He's calling on his personal phone, or maybe a burner.
This is Chet Ondowski. To whom am I speaking? The voice is smooth, friendly, and controlled. A veteran TV reporter's voice.
My name is Holly. That's all you need to know for now. She thinks she sounds okay so far. She punches her Fitbit. Pulse is 98.
What's this about, Holly?
Interested. Inviting confidences. This isn't the man who reported on the bloody horror in Pineborough Township. This is Chet on guard, wanting to know how the guy who paved your driveway shafted you on the price, or how much the power company stiffed you for kilowatts you didn't burn. I think you know, she says. But let's make sure. I'm going to send you some pictures. Give me your email address.
If you check the Chet on guard webpage, Holly, you'll find
your personal email address, because you don't want anyone seeing this. You really don't.
There's a pause, long enough for Holly to think she might have lost him, but then he gives her the address. She jots it on a sheet of Embassy Suites notepaper.
I'm sending it right away, she says. Pay special attention to the spectrographic analysis and the picture of Philip Hannigan. Call me back in 15 minutes.
Holly, this is very unusual.
You're very unusual, Mr. Ondowski, aren't you? Call me back in 15 minutes or I'll take what I know public. Your time starts as soon as my email goes through.
Holly, she ends the call, drops the phone on the rug, and bends over, head between her knees and face in her hands.
Don't faint, she tells herself. Don't you fracking do it.
When she feels okay again, as okay as she can be under the circumstances which are very stressful, she opens her laptop and sends off the material Brad Bell gave her. She doesn't bother adding a message. The pictures are the message. And then she waits. 11 minutes later, her phone lights up.
She grabs it at once, but lets it ring four times before taking the call. He doesn't bother with hello. These prove nothing. It's still the perfectly modulated tone of a veteran TV personality, but all the warmth has gone out of it. You know that, right? Holly says, wait until people compare the picture of you as Philip Hannigan with the one of you standing outside the school with that package in your hands. The false mustache will fool nobody. Wait until they compare the spectrogram of Philip Hannigan's voice to the spectrogram of Chet Undowski's voice. Who is this they you're referring to, Holly? The police? They'd laugh you right out of the station. Oh, no, not the police, Holly said. I can do better than that. If TMZ isn't interested, Gossip Glutton will be, or Deep Dive. And the Drudge Report, they always like the strange stuff. On TV, there's Inside Edition and Celeb. But do you know where I'd go first? Silence from the other end, but she can hear him breathing. It breathing. Inside View, she says. They ran with the Night Flyer story for over a year. Slender Man, for two. They wrung those stories dry. They've still got a circulation of over 3 million, and they'll eat this up. Nobody believes that shit. This isn't true, and they both know it. They'll believe this. I've got a lot of information, Mr. Undowski. What I believe you reporters call deep background. And when it comes out, if it comes out, people will start digging into your past. All your pasts. Your cover won't just come apart. It will explode. Like the bomb you planted to kill those children, she thinks. Nothing. Holly chews on her knuckles and waits him out. It's very hard, but she does it. At last, he asks, where did you get those pictures? Who gave them to you? Holly knew this was coming and knows she has to give him something. A man who's been on to you for a long time. You don't know him, and you'll never find him. But you also don't have to worry about him. He's very old. What you have to worry about is me. There's another long pause. Now one of Holly's knuckles is bleeding. At last, the question she's been waiting for arrives. What do you want? I'll tell you tomorrow. You're going to meet me at noon. I have an assignment. Cancel it, commands the woman who once scuttled through life with her head down and her shoulders hunched. This is your assignment now, and I don't think you want to blow it. Where? Holly is ready for this. She's done her research. The food court of the Monroeville Mall. That's less than 15 miles from your TV station, so it should be convenient for you and safe for me. Go to Sparrow. Look around. You'll see me. I'll be wearing a brown leather jacket open over a pink sweater with a turtleneck collar. I'll have a slice of pizza and coffee in a Starbucks cup. If you're not there by 5 past noon, I'll leave and start shopping my merchandise. You're a kook and no one will believe you. He doesn't sound confident, but he doesn't sound afraid either. He sounds angry. That's all right, Holly thinks. I can work with that. Who are you trying to convince, Mr. Undowski? Me or yourself? You're a piece of work, lady. You know that? I'll have a friend watching, she says. Not true, but Undowski won't know that. He doesn't know what it's about. Don't worry about that. But he'll be keeping an eye on me, she pauses, and on you. What do you want? He asks again. Tomorrow, Holly says, and ends the call. Later, after she's made arrangements to fly to Pittsburgh the following morning, she lies in bed, hoping for sleep, but not expecting much. She wonders, as she did when she conceived this plan, if she really needs to meet him face to face. She thinks she does. She thinks she's convinced him that she's got the goods on him, as Bill would say. Now she has to look him in the eye and give him a way out.
has to convince him that she's willing to make a deal. And what kind of deal? Her first wild idea was to tell him she wants to be like him, that she wants to live, maybe not forever, that seems too extreme, but for hundreds of years. Would he believe that, or would he think she was conning him? Too risky. Money, then, has to be. That he will believe, because he has been watching the human parade for a long time, and looking down on it. Andowski believes that for lesser beings, for the herd he sometimes thins, it always comes down to money. Sometime after midnight, Holly finally drops off. She dreams of a cave in Texas. She dreams of a thing that looked like a man until she hit it with a sock loaded with ball bearings and the head collapsed like the false front it was. She cries in her sleep.